This is about justice work. And if it's about justice work, it's not just about writing a check and giving someone some pittance of something. It is about truly working to ensure that all have an equal voice at the table.
This is the Girl Behind the Hustle podcast, and I'm Lucretia L.C. Thomas. Each week, I'm chatting with some incredible women across all industries and backgrounds who've agreed to tell the truth about what it really means to hustle. It's time for us to be honest, to let other women know that they aren't alone, to share our mountains and our valleys, to practice self-care, and celebrate our wins together. It's time to hear the truth from the women behind the hustle. This is the Girl Behind the Hustle, and I'm your host, Lucretia L.C. Thomas. Hey guys, thanks so much for tuning into the podcast this week. This is Lucretia, and I am so excited to tell you guys that everything that we talked about last week regarding the Give Back initiative is now on the website. So you can go to girlbehindthehustle.com/giveback, or if you go directly to the website at girlbehindthehustle.com, on the top banner, there is a Give Back initiative. Click there and get all the details. You can sign up there to either donate your time, donate goods, or donate just service. There's also information there and how we'll be serving you. And that will definitely kick off this week with the advertising that's available in our newsletter, on the Instagram page, as well as on the podcast. So visit the website so you can get all the details and sign up there. Of course, our book club is also underway. Once the final date for discussion is finalized, which will likely be in June, probably mid-June, we'll be sure to share that with you. But I'm excited to get into this podcast episode, guys. So this conversation I had with Liz right at the onset of this pandemic, it was right before Chicago went on lockdown, we had this conversation. And some conversations are honestly just meant to change you and to cause you to take action. And that was exactly what this conversation was. Liz Dosher of Chicago Beyond is an impactful thought leader transforming Chicago and beyond through justice work. Ebony Magazine named her one of its Power 100, and CNN followed her as a part of its docuseries, Chicagoland. In 2017, Liz served as the host of the first ever Obama Foundation Summit, as well as the Kennedy Forum on Mental Health and Chicago Ideas Week. In 2016, Liz launched Chicago Beyond, which is a philanthropic venture capital fund. This fund has invested more than $20 million in nonprofit organizations and serves as a strategic partner to help scale their impact. Listen in as we discuss the importance of restorative justice, what each of us can do to fight against inequities, and how it begins in our own communities. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the show. I'm so excited to speak with you today.
Hey, so glad to be here with you.
All right, and can you just tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and tell us about your hustle?
Sure. Well, I'm Liz Dosher. I am a former proud Chicago Public Schools principal and now the founder and CEO of Chicago Beyond. And my main hustle is really for the people. It's about making sure that we have access and resources and opportunities in Black communities.
And tell me a little about how you grew up. Did you grow up in Chicago? What was family life for you?
You know, it was a mix between the suburbs and the city. So my mom was a school teacher, and so she taught in the city, but primarily we lived out in the suburbs. If you're familiar with Chicago, we were in the south suburbs, like in the Crestwood area. So I kind of had this interesting mix of living both in the, you know, the suburban community and in the city, specifically on the south side.
And how did your family history kind of impact the work that you've done with the Chicago Public Schools, as well as what you're doing now with Chicago Beyond? Do you think that impacted your work, or is this a passion that you kind of develop later through life?
Okay, now we're about to get into some deep stuff. So here we go. You asked the question.
Just go in with it, you know.
So my dad actually grew up in the foster care system. He had a lot of, long story short, a lot of abuse, a lot of trauma in his childhood. And that impacted, you know, not just his education level, but also like kind of folks and people that he ultimately got involved with. And so my dad wound up actually in jail for over a decade. And, you know, to this day, you know, he's out of jail now, but to this day struggles with basic things like reading and some of the effects of the trauma that it still has on him. Just they're long reaching. And so for me, as I thought about what I wanted to do really with my life, I thought about my dad. And I thought about how, like, he's one of the smartest people that I know, even though he can't read, right? I think it boils down to him having just access and opportunity. And he wasn't really given that. And so hence his life kind of unfolded in the way that it did. And so for me, it was important as I thought about, you know, being a school principal and working with a school and helping our children all the way to now thinking about Chicago Beyond. I've always thought deeply about like how to make sure that Black and Brown people like have access and opportunity, because we know that within our country as a whole, no matter where you are, oftentimes your zip code, so just the zip code you were born into, has this huge determining factor on your educational outcomes, your health outcomes, your overall ability to build wealth. And so for me, that's always just been just a critical kind of point, and my family really influenced how I think of this work.
And with your work at Finger and just adopting a more holistic approach with restorative justice, mental health, and wellness, I believe you changed the standard of what educational leadership looks like in action. And looking at the results and all the programs that you put into effect, I think there were just some really bold moves that you made. But with bold moves, sometimes there's resistance. Did you mm-hmm. experience any pushback with the things that you tried to incorporate while you were there during that time?
We did experience some pushback. I mean, so just to give the audience some context, the school had... So just to give the audience some context of what was going on at our high school, we had roughly 1,500 young people. And out of those 1,500 young people, we had about 20% of them dropping out on any given year. We had about a 40% graduation rate. And we had approximately like 30 to 40% of our young people coming into high school at a third or a fourth grade reading level or below, and roughly 300 arrests inside of the school building. And that's what it was like when I got to the school. And I realized very quickly after that, like the school had, there was this narrative around the school about, you know, quote unquote, kids being bad and kids being, you know, the all these negative stereotypes. But it really wasn't about the young people. It was really about the ecosystem in which they existed. It was about, you know, lack of school funding to, you know, give kids the programs and stuff they need. It was about lack of access to healthcare. It was about restorative justice approaches. When I thought about how to, you know, really shift the results our kids were having access to. And so there were times when people pushed back. I think that sometimes during stressful periods, people, you know, don't know what to do. And so they don't know any better than to push back, to say, you know what, I don't really want to go that extra mile. I don't really understand what's happening or why. For example, like, you know, a child has, you know, issues or things going on at home that come into the classroom and a teacher getting fed up and being like, I don't want to deal with this anymore, like suspend the kid. And what we had to do was help people understand what they were seeing in classrooms. A lot of times was trauma, and then giving them the tools to deal with that. But I think once we empowered not only our team members, but our young people, because our young people were a part of this process, leading this process in terms of restorative justice, in terms of, you know, having, you know, wellness options within the school, we then began to see that shift. So that dropout rate went from, you know, 20% to down below 2%. The graduation rates doubled from 40% to over 80%. The rest went down to nearly zero. I mean, the whole school shifted. People were coming like from all over the world. And I just think that a lot of that had to do with the mental models that we had put into place that were negative and that weren't serving our children, and switching those. And once people switching those into more positive, more asset framing, and once people began to do that, they began to see the truth of what was going on. And then the resistance, to your point, began to subside.
And with having such just amazing progress and results at the school, was it hard for you to kind of pivot and start with Chicago Beyond?
It was definitely a hard shift. I think it was a necessary shift. I started to think about like where I could have the most impact in Chicago. And I thought I had given my all to the school, and it was time to start thinking about like other communities and across the south and west sides of Chicago. But it was a tough call. It was hard to leave the young people behind. That was a favorite part of my job. It was hard to leave kind of that direct access point of being able to like shift people's, you know, be able to make a decision as a principal and to be able to see like how that decision manifests itself inside of a school. You know, so for example, if we were going to a restorative justice model, that's what we decided as a leadership team. That's what we're going to do, and to see that being implemented across a school. Now is more of like a long term, more, you know, it's more of a long term play. It's about, you know, empowering other leaders of color. It is about empowering others who have ideas and how to really create an equity based society where everybody has opportunity. And those aren't like, you know, things where you kind of make a decision, do it, and you see the kind of fruits of it. It's more long term plays. So that can sometimes be challenging.
Yeah. How did you prepare your team and the community and just even the kids and yourself for that shift and pivot? Like, I've seen you in action on TV and seen how the kids in the community just connected with you. How did you prepare them for that shift?
I guess with any, it's like a human to human interaction. I don't know if it was like a, you know, a PowerPoint slide or like, you know, we're going to do these three bullets next. It was really about connection and human to human conversations about what was best for us as a community. And, you know, everyone wanted to feel better, i.e. like mental health and physical health. You know, everyone wanted to have less suspensions, i.e. let's think about like restorative justice, you know, like, and so it was more about making sure that everyone was involved in the solution and that everyone had a part of executing that solution. So for example, with restorative justice, our young people were responsible for having peer jury, which for those who might not know what peer jury is, it's basically, you know, instead of, you know, being suspended or expelled or, you know, just put out of the class, the idea is that, you know, when an infraction or like a rule is broken, you know, like a harm to the community happens, instead of just putting the kid out, it's about, you know, sitting down, the young person sitting down in front of a quote unquote jury of their peers and talking through what happened and that process of what happened, how it harmed the community. And then that peer jury, so people of the same age group, you know, are talking to that young person about then what can they do to repair harm what they did. So for example, if there was, you know, let's say, we'll give a small example of it, but like graffiti on a desk, you know, so a child comes in like completely graffitis up a desk. Typically, like in schools, like that's reason for a suspension or detention or like or some type of a punitive action that takes a child out of the school and classroom environment. But we know, like research tells us, that actually doesn't do anything for the young person, doesn't help them make a better decision next time. But if you sit down in front of a jury or like a group of their peers and they're talking through this, why they did that, what harm it was to the community, and then they have to make an amends or a repair. So maybe it's going back and cleaning that particular desk off, or maybe it is some type of community service or like, you know, ways to get the young person involved. It's a different framework by which to operate. And I think ultimately, once people, kids, adults included, got to see like the benefits of it, the humanness of it, that's when we really start to take off and start to see some of those numbers drop.
I love that because it just kind of puts the kids and shows that they hold the responsibility of their actions instead of putting it to someone that may not fully understand what's going on and the reason behind it. It kind of gives us a community aspect of let's make this decision together and how we should deal with this.
I totally agree with your point. I think that too oftentimes we like infantize high schoolers, or we infantize,
yes, absolutely.
Don't get me started on this. We infantize Black people, you know, we infantize communities as if they don't have, as if we don't have our own knowledge and we don't have our own kind of moral constitution and standing. And like, you know, like we don't know. And I think when you actually turn things over, like, and stop trying to control things and realize it's all of us in this together and we all bring something, we can all contribute to a healthy community, I mean, health like holistically, you start to see some of those results. Because like you said, people get empowered, you know? So true.
And so now, yeah, because it gives us, you know, whatever that issue may be, it gives you the opportunity to create the resolution for it as well.
Why do you think people don't do that more often in society? Like, what do you think that's trapped up into?
I think it's a shift in a mindset. Mm-hmm. I think we've always looked to someone above us or a level that's above us to kind of give us the punishment or the resolution or the solution to something instead of feeling empowered for us to create it for ourselves. I just think it's a complete shift in the mindset and shift in a system that we haven't been taught and we have not seen it in action enough to know that this is something that we can do ourselves.
I totally agree with that. I think that especially now, like you saw remnants of it, obviously, but I think of like the Black Panther movement or like really movements in spaces and places across like time, right? Or across mm-hmm. like the country. You see elements of this and then it's like kind of get squashed out by like, you know, government, for example, like with the Black Panthers. But I think like now, because like we're so interconnected by technology and because we are so, like people are tired of that. I think overall, like people just aren't going for it anymore. And it's so good to know that people feel that way and then are beginning to act like and create actions that reflect that, whether it's in our political system or how we think about schools, specifically with Black boys, or how we just think about how resources are distributed. I mean, it's just been, I think, upended, especially in the last few years, the fact that there is no single barrier to equity and that, because of that, like we all need to plug in different ways, whether it's supporting the educational system or justice reform or how we think about housing and food access. And so.
And I think definitely the work that you're doing with Chicago Beyond, just pouring into the community and pouring into these organizations that are at the ground level doing the work, is amazing.
Thanks.
And so now with Chicago, you're welcome. And now with Chicago Beyond, what does a typical workday look like for you?
You know what? It's so different. Like when I was a principal, I felt like there was no typical workday. It was kind of like you just kind of plug in where like necessary. And that could be anything from like mediating a conflict to, you know, helping a teacher lesson plan to like thinking about the strategic direction of a school, right? So, or connecting with a young person. I mean, it just ranged. This is like that, but in a different way. I feel like I find myself now traveling the country more, really talking about Chicago Beyond's model, talking about the fellow. I find myself on the road a lot more than when I was a principal. But I also find myself sitting with my team a great deal and really thinking about how we get our greatest, our own lessons of what we're seeing in the field out to folks. An example of that is us writing Why Am I Always Being Researched, which people can find on our website at chicagobeyond.org, which really challenges us to look at, you know, why poor communities or people who are currently experiencing poverty are always the ones who are researched to death, or Black people are always the ones that are researched to death. And, you know, how much, if we're going to do research because we believe that research drives decision-making, then we have to care about how it's done and whose voice is at the table when that research is being conducted and put together really matters. So, I mean, it ranges. It's always, there's never a dull moment. I'll say that.
I read a quote where you said, our kids, their potential is boundless. Is not that they lack potential, it's that they lack opportunities and access. Can we expand on this and how exactly Chicago Beyond addresses this issue?
Yeah, I always, people are such a trip, and I think we all know this, but it's so interesting when you come face to face with it. I was at this dinner, this was probably like 6 months ago, and I was with a group of, these are all Chicagoans, and it ranged from, you know, nonprofit leaders to business leaders to some philanthropists, people who, I mean, you know, had great wealth to folks who did not. And there were probably about 25 of us in the room, and this gentleman brought us together, and he wanted to talk about poverty specifically, and he wanted to talk about the, you know, quote unquote cure for poverty. And it was interesting in that he had a facilitator there, and the facilitator asked the question, you know, well, what's the root cause of poverty? And I mean, you could have heard, like, the room went completely silent, right? Like no one said anything. And a couple people began to pop up. Some of my white colleagues in the space began to pop up, and they started talking about like racism. And, you know, you could see the kind of the air kind of come back into the room. And there was a gentleman across the room who said, racism is, it's dead. You know, it doesn't exist anymore. That's about slavery. That's about the past. And so, you know, then there was a whole, obviously, like, lively debate about that and, like, structural racism that still exists today. And, you know, there was a quote, there was a debate, which really wasn't a debate, but there was a debate about, like, does that really exist or not? And so when I think about our work in Chicago Beyond's work, it's as much about actually, you know, creating opportunities for young people. So, for example, you know, funding and supporting the Lawndale Christian Legal Center to support young people, to make sure they have accurate representation in courtrooms, to make sure that, you know, whatever the root issues are around, you know, housing inequity, food inequity, education, whatever those inequities are, they have those wraparound services to support them. But also, I truly believe that when we talk about opportunity, when we talk about access, it's as much about us doing that direct service work as it is about us influencing the mindsets of people like that in the room who truly believe that everyone has the same opportunities. Everyone has the same access points. We know that it's just fundamentally not true, but helping people understand that, especially those who have like great influence over where dollars go, over where resources go, over their, you know, similar peers who have that, is incredibly important, because if those people too can begin to make more informed decisions, if they have a better understanding of what's really going on in this world, not everybody has the same access and opportunity, it then I think becomes, you know, you begin to unlock some of those tension points as a whole.
How do you deal with situations like that when you're in rooms with people who just don't understand the issues of the people who you help on a daily basis, maybe just because they weren't in those environments, maybe not exposed to those things and just haven't had those conversations that are necessary for them to kind of connect? How do you deal with situations like that?
Okay, so I'm going to ask you the same question back. I'll answer, but I'm going to ask you the same question back because I'm always curious how others deal with this stuff. You know, sometimes it's easier for me to deal with than others. I think this was a case where, I'll be honest with you, when some of the microaggressions started to happen during the conversation and some of this blame game started passing on to, like, you know, why don't communities do this? Or why don't Black people do this? Or what, you know, that type of thing. I could feel myself physically in that moment, like my heart beating, my leg was shaking, because I just, it felt like, I mean, it's like a visceral reaction to like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's just a visceral reaction to it. But ultimately what I did in that situation was I had to, like, it took me about 15 minutes to get there, but to like literally mentally talk myself off the ledge. And once I was able to do that, I was able to step back and I was able to realize, oh, this is like a script. This is what typically happens in conversations, right? Like, you know, someone comes in and talks about like, you know, poverty. And then, you know, there's going to be the person in the room who's going to play the card of this, of, oh, racism's dead. There's going to be the person that's in the room that's going to, you know, feel like they have to explain all the things the community is doing and why this does exist. There's going to be the people in the room who are going to internalize what that person said and think about like their, you know, their role. And I mean, it is true, like a script, it's like a dance. And you see it happen not only in like a dinner conversation like that, but really that same script plays out in so many different interactions that we have. And so once I was able to like calm myself down and step back and realize that, I was able to, first of all, calm myself physically down, but then realize, okay, if I know this is a script, then like, what is my response to help this person understand why actually, no, like structural racism is not dead. Like it does exist. This is what is influencing a lot of what we see in our society. Part of what that conversation had to come to was putting on the table to that person, okay, you either believe one of two things. Either you believe, as you think about our communities, either you believe that Black and Brown people are inherently lazy, that they don't care about themselves, nor their communities, or their children, Or you have to believe there's something that is causing what we're seeing in communities. To me, it's like one of two things. And so there's no like middle ground there, you know? And so I think being able to present like facts and data, you know, paint a story there that is more vibrant than kind of that one dimensional black and white picture that people try to paint is like, is important. But yeah, I meditate every day also as well. So sometimes that helps necessary. As well. So I'm curious, how do you deal with it? What's your go-to?
You know, I try to understand their perspective mm-hmm. when people say things like that. And what I have found to understand, and this is something that I have developed within the past couple of years, so it's still kind of new with me working through it, is that people who say things like that are speaking from a perspective of privilege
yes.
and not even being close to having access to understanding what's going on.
Yes.
So what I like to do is I want to inform you and to teach you mm-hmm. and not shame you from your understanding, because I know that if you truly understood, you wouldn't say things like that.
Totally.
And so I just try to inform them. And I know there was this thing that I saw this week with people saying, well, just close the school. Why not close the school? Just, it has to be done. And I went and I said, from CPS, you have kids that they only eat when they're at school. So when you close the school, you're taking away lunch. You have people that go to school because that is a safe haven. So when you take away that safe haven, where are they going outside of school for peace? You have people that come here and this is the community they build because they don't have community within their neighborhood mm-hmm. or maybe within their own home. So you cannot say things and just having people, privilege is just across all races and across all economic structures. And just explaining to them, you're saying that because you have never experienced it. You can't even begin to understand it until you actually have the conversations and connect with people mm-hmm. that can kind of explain to you what's going on.
That's so true. I 100% agree with that. I think one of the challenges, I don't know how you feel about this, but I feel like one of the challenges is like people, especially in today's society, are so disconnected and given such polarizing messages about others. We do this otherizing thing, you know, where it's like us against everybody else, you know, and I think that exacerbates some of what you're talking about as well. But when people get to hear firsthand experiences or build relationships with people who are different than themselves, you find less of what we found in that room out of a blame game, you know, because then it becomes not about like some group of people, but about individuals.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going outside of your lines, going outside of your neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah.
In one of your speeches, you said, this isn't really a black issue. It's not a white issue. It's not a Latino issue. It's not a South or a West side, but it's really an issue of our children's lives and fighting for their lives. What can people like me and the everyday person do to support your mission? How can we join that conversation and the work that Chicago Beyond is doing?
So I think one is just go to chicagobeyond.org and sign up for our newsletter. We have a ton of activations and events happening where people can plug in, and those are ever evolving and ever changing, everything from, you know, panel conversations to more like in the community activations. And so I would encourage folks to do that. But also, and I almost want to say more importantly, it's about what people can do in their own communities, you know, or going into different communities and just becoming familiar one with another and just stepping outside of their own comfort zone. I think that's always critical as well, because there's this, especially of the last several years, or I say few years, there's this, again, this otherizing that takes place. And I think a big part of the knot that we have in our society today is that everyone feels like everyone else is so different. And I think having interactions with one another is just this human to human interactions is so important. So one of the things that was happening with everything going on in the world right now, it's not happening now, but was you could sign up to go to a people supper, you know, and check, you can obviously Google and see what that is, but if the audience isn't familiar with it, but it just, you know, allows folks to have conversations with one another. My block, my hood, my city, Jamal Cole's group, where, you know, folks are just doing things in neighborhoods and connecting across like zip codes and boundaries is like, I think it's critical just to building community. And when we have community, then we just make better decisions for ourselves, but also each other.
I love that. I think community is so important just because, especially in Chicago, where we're separated, as you said, by zip code. And so it's sometimes it's easy to say, well, that's going on over there.
Yes.
And that's just going on in that neighborhood. And then when you take it outside of Chicago, it's like, oh, that's going on in that country. It doesn't affect us. But what we're now seeing is the interconnectivity of all of us.
Yes.
And what happens to that person will quickly move and affect you as well.
Yes. It's so interesting with everything happening of, you know, just with the coronavirus. It's like, if there's anything, and I don't even want to use the word good, but like, if there's any lesson, I'll say, that this is teaching us, is that we are all connected, and that nothing affects, you know, a few that doesn't ultimately impact us all. And there's this, you know, I think in the past, this feeling of like, oh, well, you know, that's happening to those people over there. But to your point, like, we are so interconnected. I think what this is showing us is the interconnectedness of us all, and how one influences, or a few influence, like, the whole. So this idea that we can somehow escape that fact, or we can just kind of live in our little pod over here and don't have to deal with other people who may be different than us or from different communities, is, like, you know, blown out the water. So
what do you wish people knew about the work that you do?
You know, I really wish that people understood that there was no single barrier to equity, and that specifically in philanthropy, we have to radically just reimagine, like, what philanthropy is, what it does, how it shows up in the world. We have to do better. Like, gone are the days of, like, charity type philanthropy, right? This is really specific when it comes to communities, their voices influence, and that we're supporting one another in that. And I think that's critically important. It's what Chicago Beyond is, like, built on. I think sometimes for people it's hard, like, well, what is your one issue area? What does that really look like? And I'm like, well, there's no single barrier. So, you know, we're investing in education and in mentorship. We're doing violence interruption work. I mean, all these different types of things, because, you know, unfortunately there's an assault on our children in many, many domains. This is about justice work. And if it's about justice work, it's not just about writing a check and giving someone some pittance of something. It is about truly working to ensure that all have an equal voice at the table.
And I know with this work, it's so transformational, but I can just imagine, with you being the face of so many issues and just attacking so many issues, how do you fill your cup up so you can continue to approach this work with optimism and hope? I know you spoke about meditation a moment ago.
It shifts. Like, you know, there was a point in time when I was doing yoga a ton, and then I hurt my knee recently. So I haven't been able to, like, do yoga for the last 6 months or so. And so I moved on into meditation for a bit. But I think it's like conversations like when you and I met, you know, it's just like talking to others who are in their own way in this work and supportive of this work. And I get energy from other people. It can be a lonely road sometimes in this work. And so talking with others, connecting with others who have the same value system, who are fighting for the same things, is really empowering. And also, of course, like, young people, that's always energizing.
What does self-care mean to you?
You know, that's a good question. I think I'm just figuring this out, like, in the last, like, I don't know, maybe like 4 or 5 months or so. I recently tore my meniscus and I had to have surgery. And so for a while, like, I literally could not walk. It was really bad before I had the surgery. And, you know, I realized that I used to try to fit self-care in. So, like, you know, do, you know, get a yoga class in, or, you know, schedule this, you know, connection time with a friend or whatever that might be. And I kind of compartmentalized self-care. If I was doing these couple of things, and that meant I was caring for myself. But when I broke my, or I'm sorry, when I tore my meniscus, I realized that, like, self-care is, like, so deep. You know, it's really about, like, listening. For me, it's about listening to my body and what I physically and mentally, spiritually, emotionally, like, what I need. And then not trying to push that aside to, like, okay, I'll get to that when I get to that in my 1 hour yoga class, or in my, you know, dinner with my friend from 4 days from now, but really taking that time for myself in that moment. And that's a privilege. And I realize that, because not everybody has the option or the opportunity to do something like that. But it's really about just listening to my body.
And that's such a shift, and just putting it at the forefront instead of like an afterthought too. It's, you know, it's definitely a shift to make. When was the last time you celebrated a win?
I'm the worst at this. I feel like I don't do a lot of celebrating. I'm always like, we got more to do. We've got so much to do. My God.
It's so hard because it's like going to the next and the next and crossing those goals off the list. And
okay, so what do you do? Let me ask you for a moment. I don't even know how to, or what have you, when's the last time you celebrated?
Oh gosh, don't even ask me. You know, me and my friend, what we started to do is to hold ourselves accountable. We do a win check-in. And if I'm being honest, we have not done one in a couple of weeks. So after we end this, I'm going to check in with her. So we do a win check-in and we start measuring our wins differently. And we said, you know, it doesn't have to be this huge thing. A win for me this week was meditating every day. That was a win. So it's like, changing how we measured our wins was so important, and just making sure that we check in with one another. Like, I did this and I did this. And that was a way that we celebrated, just checking in with one another, saying what we kind of accomplished this week that we wanted to do, even just going outside to play with my daughter after work. Like, that's a win because I don't get that time. So that's how I have started to celebrate it before. Yes. It was buying a bottle of wine, a nice bottle.
Not the Trader Joe's $5 bottle.
You know? It's like, I can go to the top shelf, you know. So just doing things like that. I don't always do those huge things where it may not be going to the spa every time, but just doing these little moments has made it easier for me to celebrate
that
daily or
so
celebrate
good
weekly.
I'm gonna completely like take that, like, and I'm taking that.
Oh, please do.
You know, I don't know. I don't think I do that enough because I really cannot think of the last win that I really celebrated, which is a problem because, like you said, it really is about kind of those everyday joys and being grateful and like in the smaller moments. It doesn't have to be some big thing of achieving a degree or, you know, solving world hunger. It is in our everyday moments that we should be celebrating. So I'll have to get back to you on that, but I will be stealing your idea.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Please.
I'm going to hold you accountable. Please. Like, hey, Liz, did you celebrate a win this week?
Hey, sorry to interrupt your listening experience, but if you're listening to this episode and you're enjoying our podcast and you've been listening week after week, do me a favor and pause, rate the podcast, subscribe, make sure you subscribe, and leave a review. Thank you. Now back to your episode.
What's a tool or app that helps you manage your life or work?
Oh my God, totally Outlook. Like if I don't have my calendar and stuff in front of me, I swear to you, I don't know what to do with myself. Like I'm like, I don't know where to go. I don't know where to be. Like in terms of work stuff, definitely that. And then I think on a person, like more of like just me every day is any type of music app. Like I need my iTunes or Spotify, something like keep music going. Otherwise, like, oh my God, like it's, yeah. I gotta have my music. So,
and do you have a go-to song that you listen to before?
Oh my God, that sounds even appropriate or whatever. But I love this "Everyday I'm Hustling." I love by Rick Ross. Yes.
Oh yeah, that's on my top. That's on my hustle playlist. Yes, I'll share it with you.
Definitely.
What book should every girl behind the hustle read?
Oh, wow. I don't know. There's so many good ones out there. I feel like I don't know if it's as much about a particular book as it is about we should all just be like reading and soaking in. I think that even in my own life, I realize I don't do as good of a job of that, of like just sitting down, pausing, reading for pleasure. Like it's always a lot of kind of ingesting, you know, content for work. But like when I think about just my own personal health and mental well-being and just all of that, it is, I think, just creating space and time.
Quote, verse, or
Jeremiah 29:11. I love, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." Favorite.
Yes, that is one of my favorite quotes. And what do you want people to say about you when you aren't in the room?
Damn, that girl's got she's got integrity. She's got heart and she's, you know, moving stuff forward.
And fill in the blank. My name is, and one truth about the hustle.
My name is Liz Dozier, and one truth about the hustle is that it never stops. Never, ever, ever,
never, ever. Absolutely
ever.
Not.
24/7, 365. Yes.
Liz, it has been such a pleasure chatting with you today. Please let our listeners know how they can stay connected with you and stay in tune with all the amazing work that you're doing with Chicago Beyond.
I'm so good to be here with you today, too. Chicago Beyond, if you want to stay in touch with us, just go to our website, chicagobeyond.org. And there's all information on how to connect with us and all of our social media posts, newsletter, all that good stuff.
I truly hope that you enjoyed this episode today and that it inspires you and pushes you to take action. I love when Liz spoke about it starts in our own communities. There's not always this big hurrah or this big thing that you have to do, but you can start by doing something today, doing something small. And when she said we're all connected, nothing affects a few that does not ultimately affect us all. As always, I would love to hear from you. Feel free to shoot an email to heygirl@girlbehindthehustle.com. The doors of our DMs always open on Instagram or Facebook at girlbehindthehustle.com. Until next week, take care, hustle, and grace.